So tonight we're continuing with our series on Active Hope, How to Face the Mess We're In Without Going Crazy by Joanna Macy and Chris Johnston. And this is not an explicitly Buddhist book, although Joanna Macy is a Buddhist, but it's very inspired by and compatible with Buddhism. And the reason that I wanted to do this series is I really found that this was the best book, the best source that I've found, basically to suggest how to face the mess we're in without going crazy, how to face it authentically, meaning environmental and social crisis stuff, how to not just turn away in denial, but not be overwhelmed and depressed, and to try to find a way to respond. And, because we, in Buddhism, we have the Bodhisattva vow to free all beings, and we have vows not to kill, and we have vows about right livelihood. And so asking ourselves, are we doing all we can? And for some people, the answer is, yes, I'm doing all I can, actually, stretch to the limit, health issues, family, whatever. But for many of us, we do wish that we could do something more or find a better way to respond or something. So this also is about that, is about finding a way to find something to do to respond. And their definition of an activist, which I want to have us kind of hold tonight, is anyone who is active for a purpose bigger than personal gain. Anyone who is active for a purpose bigger than personal gain. So that's a pretty wide definition. So just very briefly, I'm going to review the, active hope and the recommendations for cultivating active hope. So active hope, they define as focusing on working toward what you hope for in the world, rather than limiting your hope to positive outcomes you feel hopeful about. I feel hopeful that we will solve this problem. I feel hopeful that... So then that hope is very... that's just based on what's happening and your estimate of what's happening and your perception of success. And sometimes there's not a lot, doesn't feel like there's a lot of hope. So this active hope is it's a practice of shifting our emphasis away from kind of what we think is going to happen toward what we hope for, and that we're going to dedicate ourselves to it kind of regardless of what happens, just because that's the right thing to do. That's moving toward what we care about and love. So then this book is about how do you cultivate active hope. And the overarching, they present the three stories of our time, which is business as usual. And that they say, we're narrative creatures. We live with a view and a story. So there's business as usual. Everything's fine, whatever, economies will just keep growing forever. Population will just keep growing forever. There will never be any problem. We'll just keep on as we are. The second story is where some of us end up feeling stuck. Sometime is the great unraveling. It's all coming apart. It's all going to hell in a handbasket. And then they recommend a third story, which is the great turning. So it's a transition from a doomed economy of industrial growth to a life-sustaining society committed to the recovery of our world. So she makes some good arguments, they make some good arguments for, this could be a very pivotal moment in human evolution, in history, depending on what we do. So if we respond skillfully enough, if we make the changes, this could be a moment of kind of awakening and change. And then there's other ways of looking at it, kind of like You know, in all of our classic myths and adventures, the protagonist faces insurmountable odds, but finds some way through, and usually by allying themselves with, you know, good friends, and then the team goes and, you know, gets the ring back, or, you know, jumps it in the, you know, so that we can potentially cultivate that way of looking at our situation instead of the despair that usually comes from the great unraveling story, or kind of complacency, which comes from the business as usual story. So if we're committed to the great turning and we want to cultivate active hope, they talk about kind of a spiral of practice. And I think of this as, this is almost like, you know, our eightfold path, which has these eight different aspects that, you know, certain of them come to the fore at certain times, but we have to do them all. So they talk about coming from gratitude, so cultivating gratitude for what we have, honoring our pain for the world, acknowledging it, recognizing it, that's a natural response to pain and suffering, and, you know, allowing ourselves to feel that and process that, but then seeing with new eyes, so challenging our own ideas about the world and how things can work, and then going forth. It's finding some way to respond in a positive way. So they say it's a spiral because you keep doing that over and over, that you go forth, but then you might need to sustain yourself by honoring, by cultivating gratitude. You're going to feel some pain for the world, acknowledge that, and, you know, see with new eyes. So more specifically, then they break down seeing with new eyes and going forth. And we've done the chapters now on seeing with new eyes. So that's a wider sense of self, which, you know, is totally compatible with Buddhism, our sense of, you know, as long as we're concerned with I, me, and mine, leads to suffering. So challenging our idea of self and thinking of ourself as more boundless and dependently co-arisen with all things and interdependent. Also seeing with new eyes, they talk about a different kind of power to challenge our ideas about, you know, we can't do anything. I'm just a little person, and those who are, in power have lots of power. But to challenge that idea, particularly, you know, one example of that is some, you know, nonviolent direct action, where it says, you know, those at the top only have that power because we give it to them, because we comply. So, you know, you could flip that on its head. Also, seeing with new eyes is a richer experience of community, how we can't do this alone, so we end up having to make more connections with people. And one of the examples is how communities will rally and come together around disaster. And, you know, it's not like you want disasters to happen, but sometimes people, when they reflect on a natural disaster or whatever, what they talk about is how the community came together and all these amazing examples of generosity and kindness and bravery and all this kind of stuff. So that's kind of what can arise in a moment of a crisis. And then a larger view of time. So I really appreciate in this book they have a picture of the history of the world as a 24-hour clock. And, you know, here's the Earth and then the little multi-celled organisms and da 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 da. And it's only, so you're starting there, only when you get to, like, just before midnight that, you know, human beings are there. And then they use a 24-hour clock to the history of, you know, humankind. And then, you know, we're just like, we're hunting and gathering and living in groups, and we make the wheel, and, you know, and the Industrial Revolution is just like this last little sliver. So in a way, there's a way that we can look at our history and say, you know, human beings have always sucked. But I mean, you know, in our evolution, this all of this change is quite new and young. And, you know, in our evolutionary history, this is a very short period of time. So maybe we can evolve in a different direction. So then going forth, They have several things. So we've already covered catching an inspiring vision, daring to believe it is possible. And again, I know it's almost, that almost ties in as well with seeing with new eyes, because, you know, we can tell ourselves a story about our lack of power, but there are lots of stories out there about people who were very determined and made stuff happen and amazing changes happened. So tonight we're talking about building support around you. And then we have two more chapters after that, maintaining energy and enthusiasm and strengthened by uncertainty. And then strengthened by uncertainty is another one we Buddhists, you know, get pretty good. So building support around you, this is obviously very, you know, Buddhism talks a lot about Sangha and community. So they talk about four levels of support. So if we are wanting to, you know, we're active for a bigger purpose than personal gain, we have some intentions, we have some ways that we want to be of benefit to ourselves and others, and then part of doing that is building support for that intention and those actions. And so at the first level, there's the personal context of our habits and practices. Then there's the face-to-face context of the people around us, kind of social support, the cultural context of the society we're part of, and the eco-spiritual context of our connectedness with all life. So our personal context of habits and practices. So again, this is one that we talk about quite a lot in our own Buddhist practice, you know, working on trying to keep the precepts or form better habits. And she says a practice is a habit we have chosen.
We
have
what?
We have chosen. Which I really like. A practice is a habit we have chosen. We've decided to cultivate that habit or strengthen that habit. How we think about the value of what we do is crucial. If we don't see our role as important, we are less likely to take the steps required to function at our best. What helps us recognize our contribution to the great turning as significant enough to be worth taking seriously? The collaborative view of power explored in Chapter 6 certainly makes a difference, since our understanding of emergence helps us appreciate the hidden power of all our choices and actions. The great turning requires mass participation, and each of us has a role to play. But do we see our role as important enough to be worth supporting? This is a choice we can make. We can choose to give significance to our gift of active hope. So then she talks about the power of vow, which is also a big part of Buddhism. She said, you know, you can think of it as intention or commitment if you want. But she talks about a workshop where they were taking people through active hope, and then this guy at the end says, so I imagine you're going to have us take some vows at the end, right? And she was like, oh, I wasn't planning on it. He's like, oh, that's too bad. They always help me. So she came up with some vows for people to take at the end. And I didn't bring them, but you might want to check out the 14 precepts of the Order of Interbeing, which is established by Thich Nhat Hanh. There's another term for them. It's not the mindfulness practices, because that's the five precepts, but the 14 mindfulness trainings, I think, might be what they are. And they're really they're very similar to our precepts, but they take much more social responsibility and environmental responsibility into account. So they're very inspiring. You can imagine really studying them and trying to live by them, and it'd be a really beautiful way to structure your life. So in terms of our practice habits, there are many practices that can support our intention to act for our world, whether it be meditating, spending time in nature, taking daily vows, expressing ourselves creatively, or doing anything else we feel strengthened by. Each nourishing activity becomes an ally, adding to our context of support. So she started that section talking about like Olympic athletes training for their sport. And, you know, they'll think about, you know, how much they exercise, what time they get up in the morning, what they eat. You know, it's all kind of aimed at, you know, helping them perform. So, I mean, in a way, we can structure our lives and even our so-called self-care around, you know, being more healthy and able to serve. And then the face-to-face context of the people around us, she talks about asking for help, which many of us are loath to do unless we absolutely have to. But to think of the Great Turning as like a team sport, a collaborative effort, and we're all more effective and can do more with the support of others. One example of doing this, she talks about what they call them study action groups. And to some extent, I mean, in a way, this is like what we have going on with our poetry group and our book group in terms of our practice. To some extent, this is a little bit what like these Tuesday classes have been, but what she describes is like a fairly small, relatively intimate group of people who just, you know, they have some shared intention. And, you know, like reading this book or maybe studying those 14 mindfulness trainings or, they said Chris, one of these authors, he had a group that went for 6 months, meeting once a month, and they were guided by the questions, what is the Great Turning and how can we take part in it? So a deeply nourishing sense of fellowship evolved. The group lasted 18 months before it came to a natural ending point. So I'm just kind of recall a time in my monastic practice where I was really trying to rely on Zazen and on mindfulness and on practice and not just, you know, distraction and whatever. And I don't know. I would get sometimes really lonely or kind of down, and I would just kind of like, oh, you know, I'm just going to practice through this. And then, I don't know, it occurred to me at one point to just, well, let's see what happens if I just call up a friend and spend some time with them. And then I did, and I just watched, and I was like, wow, that feels good. And not in any kind of like, you know, lazy way that detracted from my practice or something. I'm like, oh, that was just kind of like a pang of social hunger. Oh, yeah, right. And sometimes, I mean, I definitely find there's a lot of stuff that I would not be able to discipline myself to do without social help. You know, the only reason I sit 6 days a week is because I have an online sitting that I commit to Wednesday through Saturday. I have to show up and ring the bells. I mean, so that kind of, you know, why is it I couldn't do it by myself? Should be enough. I mean, some people can do that, but for me, it's like, if I've promised you I'm going to do it, that's no problem. I can totally do that. But if it's just me, you know. So sometimes asking for help, recognizing, you know, I can't really do this by myself. I need some support, the support of other people, in order to follow through on this intention. And then, you know, this is totally compatible with Buddhism, because the Buddha said there's an exchange between him and one of his primary students when Ananda is saying to him, you know, I heard that you said at one point that having admirable friends, you know, friends that share an aspiration and support you in a positive way, admirable friends are half of the Dharma. And the Buddha said, no, 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 Ananda. Admirable friends are the whole of the Dharma. So then there's the cultural context How do we be supported, find support in our culture? And they talk about, in their groundbreaking study involving more than 100,000 survey responses and hundreds of focus groups, social psychologists Paul Ray and Sherry Ruth Anderson describe the growth of a new subculture committed to ecological values, social justice, and holistic perspectives. Extrapolating their findings, they estimate that tens of millions of these cultural creatives are leaving behind the old story of business as usual and creating something new. They say when tens of millions of people make such choices in the space of a few decades, we are witnessing not simply a mass of personal departures, but an exodus on the level of culture itself. This is the great turning, yet it is not always easy to see, and as a result, people often feel alone in their concern for the world. So it's very easy to look, the emphasis of our news and everything is always on the negative, and we don't see the positive stuff that people are doing. And this is a really inspiring, we think we know how our culture works, but frequently we are wrong. And here's a beautiful example. So they have this program called Cool Communities. And it is based on carbon reduction and brings together people from the same street or block in eco teams to bring about measurable reductions in their carbon footprint. And so what they do is they train, they'll train you to like go knock on your neighbor's doors and ask, do you want to be part of an eco team and, and explain it. And this is what they explain. I started with the point of view of thinking people won't want to disturb their neighbors. They'll be rejected. In New York City, where I live, people said, we don't talk to our neighbors and we're happy about it. We like our individuality. This is not actually the case, and it is a paradox. It is not so much that people don't want to know their neighbors, it's that they don't know how to connect with the people living next door and build community. As a result, we struggle as isolated and alienated individuals. The resistance of this, I don't know my neighbors, we've never done anything like this, I'm afraid I'll be rejected, is something we've experienced everywhere we've worked. But once we get people through this, using the organizing tools we provide, they come out the other side feeling incredibly excited to have that connection. Again and again, people say that what they like most about the program is getting to know their neighbors. And so they say when they do these things and their volunteers are recruited, trained, and go out to knock on the doors, the participation rate in the neighborhoods was 40%. So we kind of think we know, but sometimes we're all just thinking inside the same box, and then that's why change doesn't happen. And then primarily with the eco-spiritual context, she's talking about taking time to connect with nature. So it's not just feeling supported by human beings, but being supported by all of life. So in terms of that activism, active for a bigger purpose than personal gain, also known as bodhisattva activity, I was hoping that people would be willing to reflect, and I'm going to hand out some paper to aid that reflection if you need it. What is something, or multiple things, but at least one thing, you do to benefit other people or to benefit beings' life? And I have been long wanting to explore this with people, but I'm aware of, for one thing, usually we don't talk about this much because it sounds like tooting our own horn, right? Like, oh, and then I do this, I think for my neighbor, and then I do that, and I don't volunteer for this. So set aside the worrying about tooting your own horn, but also then putting people on the spot who are like, I don't know, I don't do anything. But I just don't believe that. If we really think about, when she was talking about this, sometimes even just our self-care, trying to take care of ourselves so we are more patient and kind or whatever. I mean, that's something that we're doing to benefit the world. We benefit ourselves. We benefit our children, our family, maybe our neighbors, maybe strangers in kind of subtle ways. Maybe it's through art or creativity. What I'm hoping is that when we share these kinds of things, that it'll be inspiring, because this is exactly the kind of thing where, in that sense of the cultural context, and we kind of figure we're alone in our efforts, and we don't really know all the stuff that people are doing or considering or taking into account. And I think it'd be really inspiring to hear what other people are doing. And then, if you want to, is there something you have thought of doing or would like to do to benefit other beings that you haven't yet? So, please hand those out, and I will do this too.
So would you say again, things you're doing to
benefit, I would say, maybe even using their term, actions you take for a bigger purpose than personal gain, bodhisattva activities, activities you take to benefit the world in some way. Oh yeah, I guess passing out the pens would be a start. And you can list a lot of things too if it comes to you. Trying to make the world a better place in some way. So any suggestions for
what'd you say?
Any suggestions for how we share? Go around. And no comparing, okay? Some people are just gonna nothing really will have come to mind, and it will come to mind tomorrow, and it won't, so they'll have a short list. Those of us who really think we're cool will have a long list. and I can start. So obviously, I like to think that the Zen Center and my podcast are sharing the Dharma with people and benefit the world. I also got my yard certified as a backyard bird habitat by Audubon just now. And the lady was pretty shocked, actually, because it was our first consultation, and I've been working on this for 4 years already, because they just made Washington County part of the program. So she thought she would be telling me, you should get rid of those invasive plants, and you should plant more natives, but I had already done it all. So she was like, well, I guess I'll certify you as a backyard bird habitat. And we had in our yard at least 2 batches of juncos and 1 batch of chickadees that family raised their families in our yard this year.
Wow.
Yeah. And kind of another one that's a little harder to get your mind around, but I was kind of thinking, I have dogs because I guess you could say that I like them, so it's all just self-serving in a way, but I also think it makes me a more sane and compassionate person. So, so I guess that could be for the benefit of the world. I try once a week to drive to Hillsboro to visit a friend of mine who, she was a Zen student, fellow Zen student over at Dharma Rain, and And she's been bedridden with rheumatoid arthritis for probably 15 years. I mean, not totally bedridden, but... And now her health has declined, and she is also has dementia. Mm. So she's in the nursing home, and she has a partner who goes to visit her every day, but I go once a week, and, you know, just... And she still, like, brightens up when she sees me. She goes, "Domio!" And she's so happy to see me, and she can't really carry on a conversation anymore. It doesn't make any sense, but she listens to all about my life and is happy for me, and then I read her David Sedaris essays, and like her sarcastic sense of humor is perfectly intact. Mm-hmm. So we like yuck it up over David Sedaris essays. I recently participated in the Awakening to Whiteness series, and I feel like that is one of the... Now I'm like, oh, white people should do that, man. I am like, I would just like, if I could totally make people do it, I would. Because I'm like, we just don't know. We just do not know. So anyway, I feel like that is something that's been beneficial. It's really changed me a lot. Something that's kind of subtle, I think, is when people, you know, when you're starting to get into a debate with people, and you want to just, like, explain how they're wrong, I just kind of try to take a breath and just kind of be with the person instead, to recognize, like, I'm not going to probably change their mind or, you know, change anything by showing that I'm right. So I just kind of slow down. Gotten involved with Extinction Rebellion. Try to mostly be vegetarian. There seems to be quite a wave of veganism coming around these days, so I feel like that's kind of inevitable. I love singing with the Dharma School kids on our once a month kids program. I go in my priest robes and we sing songs about Buddha, and I just think, like, what impression is that making on their little minds? Like, remember where we went to go to that Buddhist place, and then that the priest would come in, but she was like bald and wearing a big robe, and like she would like sing with them. Yeah,
it's really awesome. It's so awesome.
Yeah. So, would you like to go next?
I can. Well, I'd say the big thing in a lot of my time is I've been vegan 16 years, and in the beginning it was just for my health and for me, but then I've learned how it's for the animals and for our earth. Now we know we all have to eat less meat. So I think, as an example and a little bit of subtle teaching that I do, and I also help with these veg classes every year, a 6-week cooking class where I help, and I usually do a demo, and you know, I have friends that become vegan, you know, and it is, the wave is coming. It's here.
And so you'll be pleased to know, I think it made it into several term vows in our term student program.
Oh.
Several people mentioned something about their diet.
Mm-hmm. Wow. I wanted to do that program, but I had something going on. So that has taken my read a lot. I'll try to go quickly here. Yeah, I recently joined the Portland Raging Grannies, where we do a little bit of street theater for environmental things, peace, social justice kind of things. I am in a marching band. That just brings smiles to people. I give money to environmental organizations, and I support political candidates like Obama, and hopefully there's going to be something I'm really going to like. Both with money and going door to door, people I know that's really going to help make our world better. So,
thank you. And if anybody not know about the Portland Raging Grannies?
So
that's pretty.
What?
You know Lorraine?
Oh yeah, I know Lorraine. Yeah.
So you go to these, you know, protests and rallies and whatever, and then this whole group, and you're all kind of dressed like grandmas.
Like old grandmas in these flowery church hats.
Yeah.
And colorful.
And then they've rehearsed all these like rousing songs and.
There are some talented people. I think there's a song of Lorraine's we sing. I mean, about the climate, about every issue, they change the words to songs. They're amazing. And so we were at the climate strike. You probably didn't see us because there were 20,000 people there. But we sort of got ahead, and then we started just singing along the side, and people just loved it, you know.
Oh, cool.
It brings smiles to people. And
you know, cheer the marchers on, you know?
Yeah. It's fun. But,
sweet.
And there are some people in there that are a lot more. I mean, they spend their whole life with activism, you know, going to Congress. The state legislature writing letters. But it's a good organization.
Thank you. Bob?
Oh, and I will bring flyers next week. Benchfest is coming in a couple of weeks. I'm going to get inspired. At the Oregon Convention Center.
Okay. What else can we do? Lots of financial contributions. Planned Parenthood, UUA, Bright Ways In, Habitat for Humanity, Electric Car Association. We use bento boxes rather than lunch bags and single-use bags. Wax cloth for the tops instead of saran wrap. Wash cars on the grass or lawn. I know it looks rednecky, but I have an environmental engineer across the street, and she's going, yay!
Pull your car up on the lawn?
Yeah.
Interesting.
So all the soap and everything goes into the lawn,
yeah,
and it's mitigated
in
there. Minimum to no lawn chemicals. Neighbors hate the fact that I've got clover in my grass.
Oh,
it's like, it's green.
Right. Exactly.
Wait, is that grass?
Yeah, no tumbleweeds. I reuse building materials as much as possible around the house. We primarily drive around town in an all-electric car, no gas. I reuse electronic parts for my hand radio projects, and we make a habit of multiple stops on any shopping trip. So if we go to Costco, we go to Costco and Winco and Fred Meyer and the bank. It's a whole circle thing. That's it. That's enough.
Thank you.
So I guess my big one right now is that I'm serving in AmeriCorps.
Yeah.
And, I mean, the whole purpose of it is to go into communities and be of service. And, especially, like, for my particular program, bring kind of that environmental lens to different communities, particularly in the Portland area, it's communities of color and communities of low-income people, since they're been historically disadvantaged in terms of the environmental impacts. And even though I'm living out here right now and working in Gresham, I try to ride the MAX every time, which adds maybe like 20 minutes to my commute, but then I don't have to sit in Portland traffic and, you know, public transit is just way better for the environment. I try... These other ones are kind of like more out there, but I try to help critters that I find on the ground if they're kind of struggling. Like the other day, I was walking back from the MAX station and saw this bee just kind of upside down. And so I stopped and was like, here's a branch and brought it over to a tree. So I try to do things like that, even though it feels like super insignificant. It just, I don't know, the idea of putting the world out there. I try to be a good listener for people. I try to approach conversations with compassion and I do the dishes in the sink when I have time, because my family and friends I'm living with are very picky about cleanliness in the house. So I try to do my part to be in that community. And there's some things that I want to be more involved in, like I want to be more involved in like political activism, because I haven't really exposed myself much to that. I was vegetarian for a long time, then I was vegan, and then I had all these stomach problems for a year, and I went back to eating meat and dairy, and now I want to try to revert back to my old ways again. So, yeah.
Cool. Thank you.
I started with myself, and I do my best to take care of my mental, physical, and spiritual health, making sure that all my needs are met and taken care of so that I can serve everyone around me better. Which is a nice little segue to making sure that my immediate family's needs are always met, and expanding, making sure that their sense of adventure and curiosity for life is also being stimulated. And hopefully that will make them compassionate, loving beings as they turn into adults. I volunteer here at the children's program on Wednesdays. I help my father, who is in terrible health, deal with the passing of my grandparents and the stress of getting rid of their belongings and separating assets and things like that. I have a lot of siblings. I have 3 brothers and 2 sisters, and I always am an outlet or an avenue for them to vent. So they call me day or night, and they know that I'm the glue who will be there and listen to whatever it is at any time. So it's nice to have someone who's a pillar that you can always go to. I will watch my neighbor's pets if they need me to. Being there for my neighbors if they so need someone to help. I'm polite to all service workers who take care of me or anyone around me, which can be nurses or a waitress. And I rescued 2 dogs, and I give them a really sweet life with children to play with and lots of toys and treats and soft pillows. And I'm eating vegan right now, and at worst I'm eating vegetarian. That's all I've got so far.
Ooh. I keep my cat inside.
Good.
Healthier for the cat, a lot better for the birds. I've only ever caught 1 bird, both delivered and overeat that bird me once, which I didn't appreciate, but they do. Let me see what I do for people, not necessarily for the environment. I feed people, I like to cook, I like to share with people. But as far as the bigger world, I have always tried to limit my possessions. I'm more interested in spending my money on experience than items. I also limit my space, which somewhere down here that says save the trees for the birds. I mean, I live on a piece of property that's now 4 acres, and most of it's wooded, and we've chosen to have our building in a small portion of that, and I live probably in half, at least half, the space that most Americans live in. So, don't burn things. Some people love having fires, and actually our community finally decided to stop having campfires on Saturday. We do propane fires now, but better. Then looking at diet, changing it, not necessarily becoming a vegan or a vegetarian, but looking at other things to do with diet. Such as almonds are very water wasteful, so I eat a lot of nuts, so I choose what I eat, and more and more. I'll get hazelnuts. They're grown locally. I go to Fred Meyer's, and they're Spanish hazelnuts. So I went to the farmer's market, and there was the farmer, and I bought hazelnuts that came from, Dundee or somewhere down there. So more and more looking at what I can buy that is not coming to me from thousands of miles away.
Okay. For me, I really don't have a lot. My big thing is trying to make sure that I'm the best friend, brother, and son that I can be. So I always make daily goals, weekly goals. Those always include contacting my parents, they're so far from home, and also just really contacting my sister and my friends from New Jersey, from Kathy Roos in America, and also just in general that I just separate from. And also, in fact, I had a friend recently that got locked out of his car, and so I drove 45 minutes from the city to get him and bring him back. I try to live with joy. When I was in high school, I realized I was always like down and depressed, and no matter like what the grades or if I had sex with some college or anything like positive happened, I always like look at that glass half empty. So I always make sure to like live with joy, and when I wake up, just to think about what I'm blessed to have. And to have compassion for others. I think most importantly, I guess today, biggest thing would probably be like a mental shift of thinking about what am I doing for the betterment of like the world and others. Because I guess in college race and PAS racing, it's mostly about like me, go, and just like focusing on you and your growth and not really people around you. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Thank you.
I think that basically doing that of people is just committing to a daily meditation practice to be more present for my own thoughts and my own feelings, so I can be more present for other people's thoughts and other people's feelings, and act accordingly. One example of this is with my roommate situation that we have right now. We're kind of all in our own separate units, kind of going the path of ignoring things. There's so many ways to ignore the people around you and the things going on, video games, and boundless things. Distractions. So I decided to, I'm not much of a board gamer, but I know my roommates are kind of into that, so I decided to buy Settlers of Catan so we can have roommate game nights and bring everyone together. Maybe we can start having more conversations this way.
Make sure you have food.
We've done this before, actually. And as before, I'm struck by the fact that I'm most comfortable operating at a small scale, a human scale. I just want to be helpful to all the people around me. I will run people to the airport at ungodly hours to save them $50 of airport parking, or I've helped a number of people move heavy things, especially recently. And there's Sangha engagement, which is very important to me. There's opening and closing and being the sacristan this year and making sure there's always water for tea and little things like that. There's using my natural tendency to want to figure out how things ought to be at work to build tools to do things better. I don't know how it will play out in my new role, but in my old role there were a number of just really horrible data crunching jobs that would eat up your whole day. And I'm the kind of impatient guy who gets really frustrated, and I would go off and write a tool to do it all for you and then share it with everybody. Because it's ridiculous that any of you are wasting your time on something like this. And I think that's where the most of my interest lies. I try and be a good companion even for people that are difficult, like my friend Marshall, who's bitter, angry, conservative, climate change denying, pain in the butt, and I'm his best friend.
Wow.
And so he has some good traits.
It's good. He was there for me during the darkest parts of my life. We became friends because we both had the same bitter, angry, sarcastic sense of humor about the world at the time. And in a lot of ways, I've had a much easier run of it the last 20 years than he has. I've gotten to heal in ways he didn't. So even though he frustrates me, I'm not going to leave him alone.
Thank you, everyone. It's sweet. I kind of just thinking about everybody out there trying to find ways to be less harmful and more beneficial.